Okay, great. So for our final seminar of 2020, so we're delighted to welcome Nils Schoenberg as our speaker. So Nils is a PhD student from Aachen University, and so we're looking forward to your talk, Nils. So he'll be telling us about cosmological tensions and how to ease them. So please take it away whenever you're ready, Nils.
Thanks. So I was actually graciously allowed to just pick my own topic. And so you might be asking yourself, why should I choose cosmological tensions, which is a topic that many, many people talk about. But I thought about it this way. So instead of just showing off my own work, and I kind of wanted to leave you feeling that you kind of learned something very valuable for your own research and for yourself. So I will give you more like the overarching narrative of my research, and then you will be able to draw your own conclusions. So I think that most of you had already contact with some of these cosmological tensions, and I'm going to be focusing especially on two of them, which are the H0 and the S8 tensions. So one is going to be the tension in the current expansion rate of the universe, and the other one is going to be the tension in the clustering of matter in the rather late universe. Okay. And we are going to each time for each tension go through four steps. We're going to first look at the existing data, then we're going to look at what kind of tension it reveals, and then we're going to look at possible models to kind of ease this tension and what we can conclude from it. So let's start with a slightly smaller tension. So there's this S8 tension, the tension of the weak lensing measurements of late time, which kind of gives you an indication of how much the baryons and the matter in total is clustering in the late time universe. And the parameter that it most constrains is some kind of average of the oscillations of around a scale of 8 per megaparsec and some combination with the matter density. And we're just going to look at kind of what kind of data we have for this. So these are our four steps. And let's start with the first one. So for the data, we actually have a bunch of different probes for constraining the kind of power spectrum that we are observing. And we can start right ahead with the Planck results. So the Planck 2018 collaboration has released a lot of different data. And technically, these are polarization and temperature correlation on different angular scales. But you could actually convert these angular scales into wave numbers. And you can, using the assumption of the default lambda CDM model, also convert this into a power spectrum measurement. So if we have some Lmax, so maximum angular wave multiple of around 2000 for Planck, and we have some distance to recombination, which is round about 1400 per megaparsec, we get some maximum scale of around 0.14 per megaparsec, but this can vary, of course, depending on the cosmology. So in this range, you already have some constraint on your power spectrum, some indirect constraint on your power spectrum from Planck. Of course, you cannot only use a TT, so temperature autocorrelation, but also EE, which would be polarization autocorrelation, and the temperature polarization cross-correlation. I will always, by the way, show these kind of little blue lines, which just tell you which paper I'm citing results from. Okay. We can, of course, also talk about the lensing potential, which is kind of how the CMB multiples get distorted through intervening matter. So there's a distribution of intervening matter, which kind of lenses this whole CMB image. And from this, you can extract how much intervening structure there is, which we can also plot on this. Of course, there's a lot more. So these are now more the late-time measurements, where we have the large-scale structure, especially from baryonic acoustic oscillation surveys and the corresponding redshift space distortion, which you can see, for example, on the top right with the SDSS distance ladder, which is basically putting a bunch of different baryonic acoustic oscillation measurements at different times. And on the bottom right, where we have the same for the redshift space distortion, which gives you kind of how it changes over time, which includes this kind of scale-independent growth factor F. And on the bottom left, we also have a paper by Phil Cox where they kind of do this with a full shape analysis. So they kind of look at the full shape of the power spectrum. In this case, some multiples of the power spectrum, but the idea is basically the same. And you can see that from all of these, you can kind of get indirect and more direct constraints on the power spectrum, which kind of fills out with a very tight error bar. These red error bar plots, you can see with a very tight error bar, it fills out a lot of the wave number space of the power spectrum. We can also think about some weak lensing observables. So this would be, for example, DES or KITS, and we're going to talk later about what kind of tensions they give. And we can think about Lyman alpha data. And so this is, for example, from a recent paper of Palang de la Boy et al., where I put this in bold because I was part of the collaboration. This will usually be my marking when I participated in a certain paper. We had the flux power spectrum, and we can also kind of derive how this flux power spectrum corresponds to certain input power spectra, which means that you can also very indirectly, again, constrain the matter power spectrum. OK, so let's think about this tension. So back in around 2017, the issue of this kind of weak lensing tension was a bit muddled. So there was some disagreement between the weak lensing measurements from KITS and from DES. And there were some Planck, Sonnier-Selvidge clusters, which were also giving a totally different result. And it seemed a bit like there was not much accuracy in these weak lensing measurements. But nowadays, the picture has kind of shifted in that there is a good agreement now between the different weak lensing measurements, so from KITS Viking and from DES. And Planck, however, is still in tension with respect to either of these measurements, so either DES or KITS. There's also a side note about Lyman alpha data, which also kind of plays into this weak lensing tension, but is not very well known. So in the same paper by Palang de la Boy et al., we actually showed that if you consider the space of omega m and ns, which is the matter fraction and the scalar index ns of the power, of the primordial power spectrum, then you see that there's some kind of tension between the Lyman alpha data, which is shown here in red, and for example, the Planck data, which is shown in blue, or combined with Lyman alpha data in green or yellow, depending on how much lensing or baryon acoustic oscillation information you add. And you can see that there's definitely like a problem here because there's a vast difference in omega m and a small difference in ns. And if you try to, for example, just use a different ns and you say like Lyman alpha data might be misleading about the spectral index because maybe they have messed up their power spectrum slope at late times, then you will see that actually this cannot resolve your tension. And there's some residual tension, which is definitely then in omega m, which is kind of more like the curvature of these Lyman alpha data rather than just the slope. Now, you could not really see it before. For example, here's a plot of Irsek et al. In 2017, which kind of used the effective slope at a certain scale.
Excuse me, may I interrupt you? So yeah, I just wonder, so what is the physical effect that Lyman alpha wants? It wants more growth or less growth, or it's more complicated than that?
So this I will show in a second, but the basic thing is that Lyman alpha wants indeed also less growth.
Okay.
I will show this in a second. So this was not really visible before because if you look at the plot like Irsek et al., they have this kind of effective tilt at a certain scale, which kind of folds in information both of the primordial NS and the omega m.
And, can you remind me, are these 1 and 2 sigma intervals, the colors?
Yes. Okay, so the solid dark color is always the 1 sigma, and the light bright color is always the 2 sigma. Sorry. Okay. And this means that we can kind of draw the same image as before, but now also put in the Lyman alpha data. And here we can see that indeed Lyman alpha data also prefers a bit less growth in that the S8 parameter is smaller. And this is kind of an interesting result of this kind of new paper. And we're going to get back to what this also means for Planck. So there is definitely a tension, and the tension seems to be also kind of hinted at by Lyman-alpha data. But of course, I want to be skeptical of my own data. So I'm going to say that this is using some assumptions of the modeling of the Lyman-alpha forest, especially of the thermal state of the IGM, intergalactic medium, which means that we do want to make future analyses also with the new upcoming DES data, for which we will have then better constraints on this and a better handle on these Lyman-alpha systematics.
So can you remind me?
Can you explain how you get a better handle with new data? What do you need really?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I was saying, so why with new DS data you will have better handle on the thermal state of IGN, IGM? How it's...
So this is because we are rerunning simulations that we're using to like build our theoretical model. And so this is more like an improvement of the theoretical understanding and the simulation side rather than coming from the data. Sorry.
Ah, I see.
You know, just to sort of follow up on this, like, so can you remind me how you, how you constrain the amplitude of the matter power spectrum from the forest?
Yes. So if you take different input spectra for the Lyman-alpha forest with different amplitudes of the kind of primordial power spectrum or the matter power spectrum, then you will also get a different flux power spectra. So if it was just the amplitude of the flux power spectrum that would change, you would indeed have problems differentiating it from the overall flux normalization of the Lyman-alpha power spectrum. But as far as I know, it is the case that the amplitude also does like a slight curvature. And for this, you can also look at the corresponding plots in a paper by Walter et al. In 2019, I think. There should be some plots where you see that with changing the primordial amplitude, you do not just change the overall amplitude, but also like do a kind of bending of the contour.
So it's not, okay, like, so you're saying that in the forest, there is not an exact bias degeneracy the way that there is like for galaxies. You're saying
exactly.
That there's some other effect. Okay, I guess I'm not
because
seeing...
the forest is this kind of it's the flux is kind of this exponential of minus the optical depth, and so the optical depth is kind of what is almost linearly related to like the matter power spectrum, but through taking this exponential of minus the optical depth, it becomes like a like it folds this information in very non-linearly. And so this is why there's not a one-to-one degeneracy between the overall flux normalization and the metapower spectral amplitude.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this image where we have this tension in the weak lensing measurements compared to the Planck measurement. We can also show it in many various ways. So this, for example, is an analysis by Judaki et al. In 2020, where they combined the Kitts Viking data with the DESIR 1 data into some joint constraints, which is very similar to the one I used from Ascari et al. 2019. It's just different methods. But there's also the one by Hymans et al. In 2020, which was just recently released, where they actually have the Kitts 1000 data. So this is slightly more data. And they combine it also with some galaxy clustering data. So this is this 3 × 2-point red contour. And so the red contour is kind of the most constraining that we currently have. So it's a combination of this blue galaxy clustering constraint and the pink or purple cosmic shear constraint, basically, or weak lensing constraint. Okay. And we can look at this also in another plot by Hymans et al. In 2020, where we show again this kind of Kitts 1000 plot, we also now show the DES year one results, where they also combined between weak lensing and galaxy clustering. And you can see that the results, they agree quite well of kids and DES. And even the older BOSS results, where they combined with Kids Viking 450, they all kind of tell you the same picture. Basically, that Planck is kind of offset of this whole degeneracy direction of the weak lensing and galaxy clustering data. And in this way, you could think about this tension in two ways, where one of the ways is often ignored. So one way is saying it's a sigma 8 tension. So there's the amplitude of the power spectrum, which is wrong. Or another way of saying it is there might also be partially an omega m tension, which means that there's just too much matter in the Planck model compared to the galaxy clustering and weak lensing models. Measurements, sorry. Okay, so let's think about different models to ease this weak lensing tension. So let's start with like the first possible option. Let's just give the dark matter some kind of genes scale, so or some sound scale, which is going to immediately suppress the clustering below the sound scale. So why does it help? Well, you could look at, for example, the equations. So this is the equation under the assumption that the matter dominates the universe, but you can put the same equations down if you don't do this assumption. And what you will get is that this kind of sound scale, which I've written down below, is kind of very relevant for this last term. Now, the interesting thing is that if the last term has a positive prefactor, it is an oscillating solution, while if it has a negative prefactor, it's some exponentially growing solution. But of course, it's not exponentially growing because there's this kind of damping or slowing down term in the middle, which means that what you get is either some polynomially growing solution, usually like the scale factor itself, or you get some solution which is oscillatory and decaying. So these are the two possibilities for this kind of growth equation in a general model. What kind of then guides whether or not something is growing or not is whether this kind of k squared factor is bigger than ks squared, or in other words, if your wave number is inside or outside this kind of sound horizon or genes scale horizon. Okay, so how can we kind of give dark matter such a soundscape? So I'm going to do this all on an example that I've worked on myself in a paper by Heimer-Sein et al. In 2020, where we are thinking about kind of an interesting dark matter model, which is called cannibalistic dark matter. And this cannibalistic dark matter has a very curious evolution, which is that it starts like radiation and it ends like cold dark matter. And so far it's like a warm dark matter. So it starts very early on with a thermal velocity, which is very high. So it behaves like radiation. And at late times it has no thermal velocity. So it's like cold dark matter. But in between, it does actually something slightly different to, for example, warm dark matter, which is that there's some cannibalistic phase where three of these dark matter particles are reacting and only two partners come out. So this is not conserving the number count of the species. And so if you have such a reaction, then you will get this kind of cannibalistic phase if it's strong enough. And this kind of allows this species to heat itself intermediately, which means that it has kind of some grace period before becoming a cold species. And this has a bunch of cool effects. And I would like to just show you, for example, how this looks like in the equation of state or the sound speed, which starts like radiation and then it begins to drop, but it drops only very slowly. And indeed it's like one over the logarithm of the scale factor. And only at late times, if like the number count of the species becomes too low, so these interactions become inefficient, it's kind of freezing out, so to say, then this species becomes cold. And you can see that the equation of state drops towards zero. Okay. And the interesting thing about this is how does the genes horizon evolve? So we have these kind of stages of radiation-like, cannibalistic, and cold. And we now are thinking about the genes horizon. And for example, hot dark matter or warm dark matter, it would be that the genes horizon initially it falls and falls and falls because it's radiation like, and then at some point it becomes non-relativistic, after which kind of the genes scale begins to rise again, and the genes horizon, which is kind of the integral over the scale, plateaus out. And so the same is true.
Sorry, yes. Can I ask you a question? Can you tell us a bit more about what type of microphysics will give rise to cannibalistic dark matter? For example, if you have 3 to 2, it looks like there's one dark matter particle disappearing. So what stabilizes the dark matter eventually?
So sure. So there's nothing that like intrinsically prevents dark matter from just like going all away, except that this kind of 3 to 2 interaction is of course dependent on the number count of the species. So if you have a very low number density of these dark matter particles, the 3 to 2 interaction will become very inefficient, which means
But the question is, like, if I imagine in terms of microphysics, you also, I can close the, can I mean, is there interaction with the standard model, for example?
So this kind of depends on your particular Lagrangian. So in this case, we assume the Lagrangian, which just has some scalar field phi, which does not have a Z2 symmetry. So this is just some scalar field, which has some quartic interaction, and mm-hmm. thus can change the number count, has a 3 to 2 effective vertex.
But I guess, is Mina asking about, it sounds a little bit entropy violating that the...
Yeah, there is something...
Although if it was 3 to 1, it could just be forming bound states or something like that.
3 to 1, I don't know if you have a quartic. 3 to 2, where would you get the 3 to 2 from if you just have a quartic?
So this is usually, okay, I will probably draw the Feynman diagram after the session, but...
It's just confusing what type of microphysics you're imagining and how, what produces the dark matter in that case, like what determines the abundance?
So this is from some initial result of the production of dark matter through some interaction of the with the standard model.
Okay, and then afterwards, why can't you have like decay of the, if you have 3 to 2 and you have an interaction with the standard model, why don't you close the loops to the standard model and have dark matter, one dark matter particle decay to standard model particles?
Okay, I will think about this at the end of the session, but thank you for the question.
Yeah.
Okay. I think this will be a long discussion, so that's why I say probably it's good to keep it for the end. Okay. So just for the tension itself, what is interesting in this model is that the decay of this kind of equation of state is not as fast as a^-1, which would be the kind of gene scale usually for warm dark matter, for example. So this means
I have a question, which is probably follow up to the previous one. So here you are treating this dark matter as a fluid with sound speed, yeah? But for that, you need that between these particles of dark matter, the interaction between them are kind of strong enough so they don't free stream, yeah? So do you know what the conditional, I mean, whether this condition is satisfied and actually what provides these interactions? I mean, that makes it really like a fluid.
So yes, we have to impose some constraint that the interaction is strong enough for this species to have vanishing higher order moments, so to be free streaming in a certain regime, not free streaming in a certain regime, and there are also to be an overlap with these kind of cold phase where this fluid has already such a low equation of state, such that even when this kind of interaction becomes not very efficient anymore, the free streaming is not important anymore because it has such a low equation of state. So indeed, we require some overlap between these two regimes such that we do not have to deal with a kind of free streaming of the species.
And that in terms of coupling constants in the Lagrangian, or in terms of what? I mean, these constraints are formulated.
Yeah, so in our case, we had some kind of effective description of the interaction rate. And so our condition in the end was some effective condition on this kind of interaction rate being bigger than some numerical constant, which we kind of just found out from running the simulations for mm-hmm. each kind of interaction strength and seeing whether the two regimes overlap or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of strong enough interaction to suppress free streaming and being cold enough such that the free streaming is not a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we did it rather manually in the end, and we found some constraints on the cross-section from this, or the interaction rate, I should say, because we parameterized it at the cosmological perturbation equation level, not at the cross-section level.
But did you make connection with the Lagrangian?
More indirectly. But I can talk more about the connection to the Lagrangian later.
Okay.
Oh, could I just quickly clarify one thing? In the 3-2 interaction, is the idea that the final two particles are identical particles to the initial three?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Okay. So what I was saying before is that since this kind of the sound horizon is not falling as fast as a^-1, this means that around the time of the recombination, for example, we will have some sound horizon which will be at higher wave numbers k, and so at smaller scales, and thus the suppression will only begin or will not be as relevant for the CMB, because at the time of the CMB, it will be at a different scale. And this means that even though the kind of final power spectrum at redshift today can look very similar to that of some warm dark matter or hot dark matter, the impact on the CMB will be much less. So here, for example, you can see that the two horizons that I've shown in these two models of cannibalistic dark matter and warm dark matter, they kind of line up in this specific model, in these specific models. But what we can also show is that the CMB impact is much different. So for example, here, we show the impact on the CMB from all three different models. And you can kind of see the dot dash model, which is the warm dark matter or hot dark matter model in this case. And you can not really see the CAN-DM versus lambda-CDM difference for the CLs. So this was kind of very promising. It means that you can kind of avoid a lot of the CMB constraints while still allowing a suppression of the matter power spectrum. And this you can see, for example, in this plot here, where I just show as a function of the interaction strength, which we parameterized at the level of these kind of equations. So this is this gamma zero parameter here, where when the interaction becomes stronger and stronger, we get more and more suppression of this meta clustering. And it kind of tapers off towards the end, where we start to run into the CMB constraints. But depending on what kind of prior you choose, you can, of course, force yourself to be only in the region where there's strong interaction. This, however, is not really a good thing from a Bayesian perspective, so I would recommend against it. However, what we can also show is that if you just show like the samples of the MCMC, that there are a lot of samples which kind of, this is a fraction against the interaction cross-section. I didn't realize that the fraction on the y-axis would be cut off, sorry. So this is the fraction of dark matter, which is this kind of cannibalistic dark matter versus the interaction strength. And you can see that there's a large part of this parameter space, which allows for low values of S8, while still being consistent with the CMB at approximately the 95% confidence.
Sorry, can I ask, what is gamma naught? Did you define it somewhere and I missed it? Because I
no, sorry. Yes, this is what I was just mentioning in GWRT. So this gamma naught constraint is our kind of parameterization of the interaction strength.
Yeah, but why does it have units of EV to the minus? Is it like an effective operator in the dimension?
Exactly, exactly.
But it's, then why does it have EV to the minus 7? If you have 3-2 and you have some scalar, that's a dimension 5 operator.
Yes, but this one also factors in one over number density, I think. So so there's alpha cubed over m to the 7 in this operator. And this is because it's going to be multiplied with the energy density squared. So this is really at the level of the equation. So in this case, the number count conservation equation, rather than at the level of the Lagrangian, which is why, even though it's like some effective phenomenological description, it has like the scale of EV to the minus 7 instead of what you would expect from dimension counting.
Yeah, it's not very intuitive, but that's fine. You pick that. No, thank you. Sorry. Yeah, it's fine. I
just take
the weird parameter because it has funny.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not very intuitive. That's why it. Yeah, sorry, but
yeah. No problem. So this really is at the level of the equation. Maybe I should adjust the slides a bit for the future, where I just flash the equations once and like say like this is why or what we define here. So this is anyway all very toy modelish. So this is not connected to like a real underlying particle physics model, but it's more like starting from the phenomenological side. So starting from what kind of model could solve the subtle tension, what would be kind of the requirements, for example, for this kind of ballistic dark matter. Okay, so this can barely ease the tension. However, there's a problem lurking around the corner. And this I want to exemplify with the warm dark matter. So this is kind of a simpler version, which also generates some sound horizon, in this case through its free streaming. And it also has some suppression of the matter power spectrum. So for example, here's warm dark matter of 1 kilo-electron volt mass shown. And what one finds is simply that Lyman alpha constraints are very strong on this. So for example, there's two papers by Irsik et al. In 2017 using Mike Hi-Res data at higher redshifts and higher wave numbers. But even if you don't trust Hi-Res and Mike, you can still look at, for example, SDSS Lyman alpha data from the EBOS survey, for example, and you will find very similar constraints. So in this case, they happen to agree numerically at 5.3 keV. So the Lyman alpha data actually usually is a very big problem for all of these models that simply try to suppress the matter power spectrum at larger wave numbers to kind of have a lower value of the sigma 8 parameter. So another example would be dark radiation in the ESOS framework, which is the effective theory of structure formation. And there we have some interaction of dark matter with some dark radiation component, parameterized again by some parameters, but I'm not going to go into the details of this model currently. What I just want to say is that if you look at this model naively, just at the level of the CMB, it appears to be able to kind of have a strong impact on the sigma 8 parameter and also correspondingly on the S8 parameter of the clustering. But if you start to confront it with Lyman alpha data, which is a rather involved process, which this is why there's a paper citation up here of Aki Adakono et al. In 2019. If you confront it with this Lyman alpha data, you actually start to see that the low values of sigma 8 are not much allowed anymore. So what other options do we have instead of just suppressing the metapower spectrum above some scale? So we could, for example, generate some free streaming component. This was shown, for example, in Bringmann et al. In 2018, which seemed very promising, but actually there has been a study where we looked at the perturbation equations of this model, and the perturbation equations were not very promising. So there was some kind of tension in the perturbations. Generating tensions, so to say, with the CMB. And so we wanted to write a paper about this, but it's not very nice to just write a negative paper. So we are waiting for a bit more data to have a more positive outlook. There's also some parameter degeneracies that you could use. So between S8 and, for example, H0. However, this would require you to have a larger H0, which kind of brings us directly to the next tension. So let's maybe conclude.
Yeah, let me ask you. So why option two is different from option one? Can you explain like physics? Because in both cases you just get some separation. So why free streaming is different from sound scale? I don't know. I mean, in terms of observations, I mean, observables.
Yeah, exactly. So my difference between option one and option two is not that there is some free streaming or sound scale. My difference is that for one, it is either given to the dark matter itself, or two, it is generating a new component, i.e. Like a decay into a new component or a new species that is generated throughout cosmic history, so to say.
Yeah, and also another question. So have you looked at fuzzy dark matter, some admixture of fuzzy dark matter?
Ah, yes. So fuzzy and axionic dark matter, of course, this is another topic all in itself. And I have to admit, I'm not an expert on axion dark matter. So I have not looked very much at axion dark matter yet and this kind of full discussion. But I think that the conclusion that I'm going to give in a second might be also relevant for axion dark matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Though I'm not an expert on axion dark matter again. So this probably someone else can answer better for you who is working on this directly. So in this edited plot by Chabanier et al. In 2019, you can see that we have once again plotted all the different kind of constraints on the matter power spectrum. And I now highlighted the region where the sigma 8 or the S8 has most contributions in the cosmological sense. And you can see already that the Lyman alpha data is simply on larger wave numbers and larger scales than what the S8 or sigma 8 is sensitive to. This means that I draw now very simply, if you want to have a model which kind of suppresses the power spectrum after the CMB scales or after the weak Lensing scales, then what you usually run into is trouble with the Lyman alpha data. And so here, of course, we can have many solutions. So for example, one solution would be to have a much more shallow suppression or shallow dip, such that you do not run immediately into this Lyman alpha constraints. Or you could also think about modifying the thermal history of the intergalactic medium enough, such that you kind of avoid these Lyman alpha constraints. Or finally, a third option is also to modify, instead of modifying sigma 8, you could also modify, of course, omega m. And thus you could slightly ease the tension without running into these kind of Lyman alpha problems. And so these are like, this is kind of like your set of options that you can usually use to avoid this discrepancy between your suppression from the power spectrum at scales where it impacts sigma 8 and where it impacts the Lyman alpha forest. Okay, so this is now dealing with one tension. So we have a big problem with solving this tension just because there's this kind of Lyman alpha data overlapping with the suppression that we want to get a lower S8 or sigma 8.
But before that, though, can I ask, sure. You know, so for this cannibal model that you mentioned, you know, so did you guys check whether or not the same processes will be important inside of, you know, present day like dark matter halos?
No, we did not check that yet. So we only had this very simple toy model. So we didn't actually manage to do a lot of constraining power for or think about the constraints from these kind of late time probes yet. So this was left for future work, so to say.
Uh-huh. Because it seems like you were requiring like a pretty large self-interaction rate, you know, at high redshift. And then I just, you know, wonder then if today there will be significant like scattering of dark matter, you know, or annihilations even like you had. But okay.
Yes, yeah. And I remember that we might even have a comment about this in the paper because I think someone brought it up, but I will check in the paper because I don't remember this exact footnote, so. There was a footnote. So
on that note, this 3-2 scattering, does this go as the cube of the density? Is that the way it works?
What you mean with it causes a cube of the density?
The rate of this 3-2 scattering that you mentioned, or 3-2 mm-hmm. cannibalism, does it go as the cube density or density cube?
I think it goes So the interaction rate is, I think, the multiple of this interaction rate parameter gamma zero and the density squared.
Is it called as density squared? Okay. I would expect that if it's three body interaction, it usually should go as density cubed, I would think. But either one of those.
Yeah. You're completely right. So it depends kind of on what kind of equation you're referring to. But if you think about the number count conservation equation, mm-hmm. I think you're right. So it depends on how you define it, but the interaction strength of the one particle with two other particles, of course, goes with the density squared. Okay. But in total, this result, of course, in the density cubed.
And then for density cubed, do you just use the mean density of dark matter for that?
Yes, which I think you will also say that, of course, there is places with stronger dark matter. And so in these kind of halos, you would, of course, have an enhancement of this. However, the until late times, you've basically frozen out this 3-2 interaction. So you would probably only have the 2-3 interaction dominantly in these halos.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. So it's going to be a very big effect from halos, right? Because
well, except that the J factor, it's not going to be having a row. I would have to think about this.
People usually have talk okay, about density as squared. This is density cubed. So this is even.
But this is not annihilation into standard model particles. This is 3-2 interactions. So this is it increases the energy of the two remaining particles. That's true in the halo. Mm-hmm. So it would definitely have some consequences, but it would not directly lead to like gamma ray or some directly observable.
Sure, but that's true. Yeah, but I guess my point is that there would be a significant correction because of the clustering.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay. So let's get to the other tension, which is the H0 tension, the Hubble tension. And we will once again follow our four steps with the data, with the tension, the models, and the conclusion. Okay, so the data is, for example, the cosmic microwave background data, which we can, for example, also plot the Planck data and data from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, the South Pole Telescope, the BICEP Keck Array. And let's maybe zoom in to see more precisely what kind of this CMB data does tell us. What it most strictly constrains is actually the position in multipole number of this first peak. So the angular scale of the sound horizon is how we call it. And what it also constrains more indirectly is, for example, the ratio of the different amplitudes of these peaks and the overall damping tail. And these will give you the, will be proportional to the reduced matter density, which is the matter fraction times the Hubble constant squared, and the matter density times the Hubble constant cubed, respectively, and also the damping tail. We have the local measurement of the Hubble constant using the distance ladder. And so this is using some geometry to anchor the Cepheids, some Cepheids to anchor supernovae, and then it's using the supernovae diagram to measure the Hubble constant. So this is, for example, using data like the joint light curve analysis, which includes the shown supernovae samples. So what you can actually do there is replace the kind of anchors that you have. So for example, the Cepheids with different standard candles. And this will be an important point that I will make in a second. There's also cosmic chronometers, which you are looking at kind of the stellar evolution of very massive early type galaxies. And from these, you can infer kind of from a certain spectral break, the age of this galaxy. And then if you have some differential age measurement and some differential recording of their redshifts, you can get some estimate of the Hubble parameter at different redshifts, which will be almost direct measurement of the Hubble parameter, but at usually relatively high redshifts. So this is much larger than 0.1 or so. So you also have strongly lensed systems. So these are systems where you have a single quasar, but through stronger rotational lensing, it's imaged multiple times. So here you can see, for example, four dots in this picture to the top right, which is HE0435. And since there are some variation in these background quasars of the order of 10 days, it shows up on the background images in the order of months apart due to the different travel time of the light due to the different paths. So this means that you can actually reconstruct the distance to the various objects. And from the distance and the known redshift, you can actually reconstruct an estimate of the H0 value of the Hubble constant. And you can see here that it is relatively high. So it's a bit higher than 70, so 73 or so. But there's also other possibilities of doing this. So one possibility is the path of the baryonic acoustic oscillations and using Big Bang nucleosynthesis data in combination. So baryonic acoustic oscillations actually constrain the angle of baryonic acoustic oscillations, so some angular separation and some line of sight redshift separation between galaxies. And along a certain scale, they are much enhanced. The clustering is enhanced at a certain redshift distance and angular distance. And these you can measure. The angular distance corresponds to the sound horizon over the angular diameter distance, while the redshift distance corresponds to the sound horizon times the Hubble parameter, which means that in both cases, the kind of sound horizon is important. And if you want to make any measurement of H0 from this kind of BAO, you need to somehow specify the sound horizon. For example, you can look at the formula for the sound horizon, where you can see that it depends on a lot of early time physics, which depends on the matter density and how radiation behaves at early times. But it also depends crucially on the sound speed, which depends on the baryon fraction. And so there's one way to fix the baryon fraction, which is through Big Bang nucleosynthesis. If you want that the deuterium over hydrogen ratio and the helium over hydrogen ratio agree well with the Big Bang nucleosynthesis measurements, then you will be forced into a certain parameter region where you have a certain number of ultra-relativistic degrees of freedom, which is very close to 3, or the difference between this and 3 will be close to 0. And you will be forced into a region where you have a certain well-defined baryon fraction. And so you can use this baryon fraction to kind of put into your sound horizon. And then you know your sound horizon, and you can estimate the angular diameter distance and the Hubble parameter. So if you have the Hubble parameter and the angular diameter distance at different redshifts, it actually turns out that they have different degeneracy directions with these underlying parameters of H0 and omega m. And these different degeneracy directions at late times, low redshift, and early times, high redshift, you can actually use to have like contours with different degeneracy directions intersecting at a certain place. So this, for example, is using the early time quasars from, or the bioacoustic oscillations from early time quasars, and the they're kind of gotten from the Lyman alpha forest of these quasars. And you can also look at the late time galaxy clustering, and you can see that they have very different degeneracy directions. And if you trust both measurements, you will find that there's a very shallow overlap between the two, which is exactly around this kind of red region here, which agrees well with this kind of purple almost line here, which corresponds to the Planck measurement in the omega m and H0 plane. So this measurement or this kind of prediction is very independent of this kind of Planck measurement. And this is kind of a big advantage, which we've shown in the 2019 paper, that you can get these kind of very independent constraints, which will be relevant for the Hubble tension. So let's talk about the actual tension. So what you usually see for the Hubble tension is you see a difference between the kind of late time distance ladder, which is here the Schuh's result, and the early time CMB measurements, which here is called Planck TTTEEE. However, there's also a bit more. So for example, there's much more early time data. So there's also the Atacama Cosmology Telescope and the South Pole Telescope. And they actually paint a very similar picture, except that the South Pole Telescope allows for much higher values of H naught, though with a high error bar. There's also the strong lensing that I just talked about, which gives you a value which is very high and very similar to this kind of local distance ladder value. There's a bunch of variations of the local distance ladder value, which correspond to using different kind of anchors that I talked about. So instead of using Cepheids as standard candles, you can also use the tip of the red giant branch, which would be the CCHP. You can use surface brightness fluctuations of galaxies, which would be SBF. You can use some water masers around supermassive black holes, which would be this Megamaster Cosmology Project, MCP. And you can use some tip of the asymptotic giant branch, which would be MIRAS, is how the variable star is called. So all of these are kind of different anchors for this kind of local distance ladder method. And you can see that most of them kind of agree that there should be a high value. But for example, the tip of the red giant branch is disagreeing with this conclusion. I will skip over this kind of detail about the anchors, but there's some inconsistency even in the anchors for the Cepheids, namely between the Large Magellanic Cloud and the NGC 4258. But I will skip this point. We have the late time measurement of the combination of baryonic acoustic oscillations and Big Bang nucleosynthesis that I mentioned. And we have a kind of very intense discussion about these strong lensing measurements, because there's a so-called mass sheet degeneracy, which kind of makes these constraints much more, broadens these constraints much more. And you can see that the one sigma bar blows up to a degree where we cannot really use it currently to constrain anything. You can try to constrain this mass sheet degeneracy, but what happens is actually that then you're driven to lower value of the Hubble constant again. So this is using the information about the surrounding galaxies of these kind of strongly lensed systems to kind of enforce or find out what the 3D density profile of these systems should be, which is the reason or the cause of this mass sheet degeneracy. So in the end, we are left with, so this is also, you can also use gravitational wave events if you have an electromagnetic counterpart. So in the end, we're left with a quite varied picture of the Hubble tension, where we have a lot of late time measurements, which kind of have very broad constraints and very high values of H naught. And you have a bunch of early type measurements, which have very tight constraints on H naught as well, but at a much lower value. And now the big question or the big race is finding what is kind of the difference or what causes this kind of problem between early and late time measurements. And there are some arguments about systematics, for example, of this shoes that I didn't touch upon, but we will focus now on cosmological models that can solve this. First, I want to quickly, or maybe I skip this. So you can also look at this in the omega m H naught plane, but I don't think this adds enough. So I will skip this point, and instead we will visit the tension itself through different models. So how can you change this kind of inference of the Hubble tension? How could you change the late time Hubble expansion? So for example, you could just imagine that you play around with the Hubble expansion as a function of time by adding some arbitrary cosmological ingredients. So for example, some dark energy, which has an equation of state, which is not minus one, but varies with time. And you could imagine what kind of do you have to do to keep the CMB looking approximately the same. So the CMB fixes its count scale, which is approximately the sound horizon over the angular diameter distance to the CMB. And since the sound horizon is fixed, if we only vary cosmology after decoupling or after recombination, we have to vary instead the angular diameter distance to the CMB. And from the formula, you can see that if this H naught value wants to go up, we have to actually decrease this H of Z over H naught value. So to keep this angular diameter distance fixed. So if we look at this expression for H of Z over H naught in the late time universe, you can see that we have some meta contribution from the Hubble law, and we Feynman-Lemaitre law, and we also have some dark energy contribution. And so when we want this whole thing to go down, we have a fixed parameter, which is basically omega m. And so what we could imagine is that we play around with dark energy. We just say, well, maybe dark energy was smaller than back in the day than it is now. But you can actually show that this requires that at some point, this kind of equation of state dipped below minus one. And now this is very hard to motivate, let's say, because it means that you will have some phantom dark energy. And this kind of violates some weak energy conditions, which you don't really want to do. So this also appears if you are completely agnostic to the kind of specific dark energy model and try to do this using, for example, a Gaussian process regression, which is kind of looking at which kind of possible functions could replicate a high value of H naught if I just play around arbitrarily with this dark energy equation of state. And from the measurements that we have in this intervening region, we actually find that you do need to go somewhere below an equation of state of minus one, such that you get this kind of nice solution of the Hubble tension. Another possibility would be, though I won't go further into this, of course, changing the matter density at late times. So having some matter decay away or something like this. Okay, so you have strong constraints at redshifts below around 2.5 from baryon acoustic oscillations, and these kind of cosmic chronometers. And so you are basically stuck with a problem of changing the Hubble tension. There's another way of doing it, which is you could change the inference of the Hubble parameter from the CMB. For example, you could play with the degeneracies. There are three big degeneracies among all of these degeneracies that I show here, which is the N-effective, omega M, and omega K parameters. So for N-effective, we've seen that it's mesh constrained by BBN, for example, and you can also independently constrain it with BAO and BBN, and let's cross it out. For the omega M parameter, there's actually a problem with the with how, if you vary omega M, the CMB becomes overdamped. So there's kind of a damping barrier. And the final contender is omega K, which seemed promising in around 2019, where people showed that actually from the Planck perspective, negative omega K would be kind of preferred. But it was soon rebutted in 2020 by Staffio et al, which showed that if you include late time measurements, this solution is not good anymore. And this is because the curvature contribution to the overall energy budget of the universe decays only as the scale factor to the minus two, which is simply too slow. This means that if you want to have there some relevant curvature at the CMB times, you will necessarily mess up the late time probes. So supernovae and BAO probes. So there's a third option that we could go to, which is changing the inference from H0 by changing the value of the sound horizon. And now this is kind of a trick in which we change upwards the sound horizon. And thus we also have to change upwards this angular diameter distance, but it's inversely proportional to H0. So if we, for example, lower the RS value, we can accommodate a higher H0 value. So this was, for example, shown in Chiang et al. In 2018, and it has released like a flood of papers about this, all trying to change this kind of sound horizon. So for example, by changing the baryon sound speed, this didn't work well because it kind of messes up the rest of the CMB peaks as well. By changing the early time expansion history before recombination, so this has worked relatively well as shown in a paper by Poulon et al. Using early dark energy. And I will not go too much into detail about early dark energy because we're a bit short on time. But if you want, I can afterwards talk a bit more about it. And this early dark energy solution seems initially promising if you look at SPT poll data and structure data like BAO and supernovae. But actually, it's slightly in tension if you also include sigma 8 data, So this is weak lensing data. So if you solve the H0 tension using early dark energy, you kind of enhance the sigma 8 or weak lensing tension. Okay, there's of course many more opportunities to change this Hubble expansion rate before recombination. So I'm not going to go into all models. You could also change the redshift of recombination, which there are various models of doing this. For example, if you do inhomogeneous recombination, it actually turns out that recombination will happen earlier. Though in all of, there's one more way of doing this, which is if you kind of avoid this damping barrier by using the perturbations of your kind of fluid, then you can also get this, which is, for example, shown here in the paper recently by Beck et al. In 2020, where dark matter dark radiation interactions kind of suppress your damping and thus allow you to avoid this damping tail and allow you to go to much higher values of H0 by increasing correspondingly the dark matter fraction, omega dark matter, which, however, can be done independently of S8. And especially if you combine multiple interactions, for example, with dark radiation and with photons, you do allow to solve simultaneously the H0 and the S8 tensions. But there's a more general problem, which is that if you want to solve your Hubble tension by playing around with your sound horizon, then actually it turns out that the degeneracy direction of the baryon acoustic oscillations and the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, then opposite direction to what you get from CMB. So this has been initially shown in Jamzik et al. With a slightly interesting fixing of things that are not actually most constrained by CMB. But even if you follow along the CMB degeneracy lines, you can see that there's just two orthogonal directions. And so you will have a problem no matter what. So what you would have to do is really have a movement of the whole BAO contours from your model. So let's conclude since we're at the end of the time already. So for changing the Hubble parameter after decoupling and at very late times, it's looking a bit grim because you would need something like phantom dark energy, which is violating some weak energy conditions, which you usually don't want to do. If you want to change H0 just from the inference by playing with the parameter degeneracies of the CMB, it's also looking kind of grim because the degeneracies are actually well constrained from different probes like BAO, supernovae, BBN. Finally, if you want to change the inference from H0 from the CMB by changing the sound horizon at the time of recombination, this is actually looking quite okay, though there need to be some things ironed out, like the impact of early dark energy on this kind of S8 tension and so on and so forth. Okay, there's another option which I'm not going to go too much into, which is self-inducting neutrinos, which is not really liked by Planck polarization data. So let's skip over this. Okay, I guess I just skip to the conclusion. So there's of course some future possibilities with new experiments and new models, but I don't need to bore you with this, I think. So thank you for listening.
Okay, great. All right, thanks, Neil. Yeah, so let's all unmute to give him a round of applause. Okay, so any further questions for Niels? Please just jump in and unmute. You don't need to raise your hand.
So I was curious about this self-interacting neutrinos because I think I heard that was, I guess, put forth as a solution to both S8 and H0 tensions. But you're saying that it's inconsistent with polarization?
Yes. So let me go back a bit. Sorry for not having the time to go into this in too much detail. But this was shown in a very recent paper by Shudori et al. In 2020. So this month came out, I think, today or yesterday, I think.
Ah, okay.
And they actually showed that while with Planck 2018, it is still preferred with the TT data alone and the low E of the polarization. It is not preferred anymore if you include high L E polarization. okay. or other external data sets. So you can kind of revive this from the posterior if you force to include a reset IL 2019 data, but I'm not sure how feasible this is because you're kind of including incompatible data sets. So you always have to be kind of careful about doing something like this.
Right, right. Okay. Thanks.
I also list this kind of reference here. So if you want to look at the paper 2012 07519.
So option one, this changing HFZ, if you don't worry about having this phantom dark energy, can you actually fit all the data with this option one?
Yes, though you have to be a bit creative about your precise model. Let's see where I discuss option one.
Yeah, because in particular, I remember people talking about that you don't fit the larger scale structure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a bit careful because you have to do this all at the correct redshift. So okay. Between redshift 2.5 and 0 approximately, you have these kind of very strong constraints from baryonic acoustic oscillations, which means that your phantom dark energy model that you chose cannot deviate too much from being like ordinary dark energy. So this is definitely true, but you can be creative and play around with it. So for example, a couple of days ago, I saw a paper on the archive where they simply used like some emergent phenomenon, like similar to ferromagnetism, where they started with a very negative equation of state at like redshift 2, and then it quickly exponentially decayed and became very close to -1 at redshifts of 1 or 0.5 or so, which is very close to baryonic oscillations. So you can play around with it, but as you say, you have to be very careful not to run into the BAO and other large-scale structure constraints. This is very much true.
Thanks.
I didn't quite understand. So in this model, like the equation of state is close to -1 today until like redshift 2, and then it's below -1. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So, and this has an effect. I mean, so even though like the omega in this component is so tiny because it's like always -1 or less, even at high redshift, it has an effect. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's due to the particular nature of that model, where they somehow allow this equation of state to blow up towards redshift of around 2.
But by blow up, does that mean that it's like even more negative than -1?
Yes. It goes to like -100 and more. So it becomes like this, because they have like a weird phenomenological motivation of this, like in accordance to ferromagnetism. So I'm not too keen on that paper, but I'm just saying, like, if you're creative enough, you will probably find a way to slip through this kind of BAO net.
I'm just surprised that this does anything, right? You know, because if the equation of state is like -100, you know, then as you go towards higher and higher redshifts, then its energy density becomes even tinier, right? I mean, so it's like, so its energy density grows over time, right? And so, you know, and so if it's like omega of like less than 0.1, you know, at redshift 1 or 2, then at even high redshifts, then it's completely negligible. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just surprised that it does anything.
Yeah. Of course, if the equation of state is less than -1, it of course means that instead of shrinking with cosmic time or with the expansion of the universe, or the number density diluting, so to say, it's of course increasing. So this means if you just make omega negative enough at some certain time, you will have like it blowing up. So in this case, it's like suddenly there's like this emergence of this dark energy. And then it kind of tempers out and becomes ordinary dark energy and becomes kind of constant.
Does it become, does W become bigger than -1 in that scenario or not? Here it does become bigger than -1.
No, so in that model not, but I also think that that paper was not like looking at enough large scale structure data. Especially they weren't concerned with any perturbations or anything like this. So they couldn't, for example, use the sigma 8 constraints or anything like this.
Mm. Okay.
Because they didn't have a model for perturbations because they had this interesting motivation.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Right. So I didn't keep track of the time. I see that we're like way past time. Sorry yeah, exactly. about that. Sorry about that. Okay. So let's stop here. So let's thank Nils again for his great talk.